Good evening and welcome to another edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. We have a very interesting cast tonight. Over the summer, news broke about a new digital platform being developed specifically for indie games that goes by Jump. And the unique marketing tag for it was that it was going to be a subscription service and what people were quoting around as the Netflix for games. And it is now out now, and we're going to be talking about it tonight in terms of what it is and what it's offering the indie game market with the CEO and founder. So please welcome from Jump, Anthony Palma. Oop, are you still there, Anthony?
Yes.
Oop. Sorry, I thought I lost you there. All right.
I'm still here.
All right. Anthony, it is great to have you on tonight. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. This is going to be, I think, a very interesting cast because there really aren't a lot of discussions about the indie game market, especially for games that aren't, you know, the top 10 on Steam, the mega successes and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. It's been an interesting few years for indie games with the meteoric rise 5-10 years ago, and then kind of with the introduction of different ways for developers to get to market through Steam Greenlight and now Direct. And the flood of content that's come since, it's been pretty interesting to watch it all happen.
Definitely. And I've had a chance to speak to many indie developers over the last few years, from those who have had those amazing successes and sadly some who didn't quite hit that mark. And it's just a very fascinating mark, and it's one that has definitely become a major aspect of game development. I know from speaking to many developers that a lot of people in the AA, AAA space have basically entered the indie market as a means of making the games that they want to make.
Yeah, I think that's a great representation of what's been happening. People get their experience at large studios, they understand the workflow and really kind of how to build optimum games so they go into the indie space. But now we're getting to the point where great development skills aren't the only thing that launches successful indie companies.
Definitely. I agree with you on that. But yeah, feel free to finish your thought.
Oh, it's just that now we've gotten to the point where you need a skill set of a marketer and potentially a PR representative and really a deep understanding of how the channels work to get to market and how to build virality through non-traditional advertising and influencers. And it's 5 years ago or so, I think leaving the AAA industry to go indie was really desirable because you could build a name for yourself. But now even indie devs that have had tremendous success, the previous titles are struggling with their new ones just because of the overwhelming amount of content that's in the market. So it's getting tougher and tougher to be an indie developer. That's for sure.
Definitely. And it's even being harder for people like me talking about the game industry because the market is so open now. It's just anyone can really get into it, and it becomes very hard to separate the signal from the noise.
Yeah, I think that's the big challenge that Steam has had in opening up the floodgates with Greenlight and now Direct is how do you allow the cream of the crop to really be found among the noise that is shovelware and everything else that's coming out onto these platforms. So, it was a problem for mobile first, and now it's a problem for Steam and desktop. And I think developers of all quality levels are seeing this issue of discoverability and not being able to get their game in front of their target audience. And then when they do get it in front of them, having to fight for their dollars.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned discoverability there, Anthony, because that is going to be, I think, a big focal point later on in our talk. But sure. I know we have a lot to get to, and I figured let's get started with what I like to always ask our new guests on. For people listening to this cast who don't know who you are, could you kind of go over briefly your background when it comes to the game industry?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from West Virginia. I live in Los Angeles now. I went to West Virginia University for computer science and computer engineering. So I come from a technical background. Mm-hmm. And then I went straight to Carnegie Mellon for a master's program there in entertainment technology, which is really what got me into gaming in the industry. I briefly worked with Disney Imagineering. And while I was there, I was working on a game in my free time with some friends. And it made me want to go into indie development. So while we were graduating from Carnegie Mellon, myself and three other classmates, one of which is actually still with us, he's our VP of design, founded this company as a game development studio, building indie games way back in 2012. We quickly realized that building indie games was incredibly tough. That was around the time that Greenlight had launched, and you know, we went through the whole Greenlight process, but by the end of it, as we were finishing up the game, we realized it was just going to be very difficult to even make our money back on the game, let alone to turn a profit with it or for it to be a hit success. We could see that it was a good game and people liked it when they played it, but it wasn't going to be a Bastion or a Limbo or one of the hit games that had run away and really launched people's careers to be stable indie developers, which is kind of almost an oxymoron now. And so end of 2014, after a rough year of just doing contract work and whatever we could to keep ourselves afloat, we started to see some trends in technology happening that would potentially help solve the issue that other subscription services had in the gaming space. But also it seemed like a way for us to try to solve discoverability for games that deserve to be discovered. And so 2015, we started working on the idea that would eventually become Jump. Earlier this year, we raised a round of funding to go from three part-timers who were doing it in their evenings to 10 full-timers, which is what we have now. And that includes industry veterans like Cindy, who used to work at EA and Ubisoft, folks from IDOS, folks from Sony. Just a hell of a team, even the former VP of publishing from Humble Bundle, all working with Jump now. And that's what brings us to where we are today. So we launched on September 19th. We were very well received, and we're just now starting to scale the service now that we have about 70 games on the service, and we'll be adding 10 a month here on in.
Cool. And for those of you listening to the podcast right now, we are recording this just about in mid-October. So chances are by the time this cast goes up, there should be more games available on Jump. But as you say, Vinny, it is definitely a very tough market to get into. And I think it's one of those things that a lot of people don't think about. As you were saying a few minutes ago, a lot of new developers think that just having a great game or even just a good game is enough to get profitable or just to sustain your studio. But there's just so many more factors these days. And I think what you were saying about your game is very telling, that I've heard similar things from other developers, that they have a game that people like, but having a game that people like and a game that people are actually going to pay, you know, enough to keep your studio running are two very different things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say that it was very true that if you had a good game or a great game and it got onto something like Steam or one of the consoles back in maybe 2010, you were basically guaranteed a certain amount of success, financial success and visibility back before the green light doors opened and before things like Xbox Live indie games really drove down the perceived value of indies. And so back then, you know, you could build a decent game and make $50,000 to $100,000, even if it had no marketing budget, right? Just because you could get visibility in front of a large audience. So so now the tides have definitely turned to where there's a flood of content, but it's hard to get your game in front of the right audience, let alone to make it attractive enough as a purchase for these users that are very money conscious. And if you look at the trends over the last 5 years, spending has not really changed in gaming. People are still spending roughly what they usually spend annually on games. So what that means is that on average, the number of sales per game has plummeted because the number of games has skyrocketed, even though spending hasn't changed. So it's been a very difficult few years, I think, for indie developers. And while you still see huge successes like Cuphead, I mean, that's a very rare example, right? And there's a thousand other ones of games, even from very popular devs that that just aren't doing what they did 5 years ago.
And I'm glad you brought up Cuphead there, Anthony, because for those of you listening to this cast, in October, it was revealed that the game has broke the million copies sold mark, which is a great milestone for Studio MDHR. But again, that's not the norm. And for a lot of first-time developers, especially those going from college and getting directly into indie game development, That's not going to be the regular thing. And as you just said, Anthony, there have been sadly many examples of really great games, whether they be from smaller studios or even from developers with established backgrounds, that have failed to crack the market.
Yeah, it's been, you can see example after example, whether it's, you know, the pretty famous story about the Prison Architect guys and their second game that only sold about 6,000 copies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's other factors that go into things like that, like the game being pretty different instead of it being a sequel. And but it's not enough to have a good game, and it's also not enough to just be a well-known developer anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much more that goes into getting your game discovered, and a significant amount of campaigning that has to be done to reach the right audience and to get convince them that they should be buying it with their precious dollars.
Yes. And I can already tell you, or to the folks listening, that we're not going to be covering the full extent of the indie market or marketing in this podcast. That's probably a good 5 to 10 hour chat if it's nothing.
Yeah.
But in terms of what we're going to be talking about, we're going to start with at least a little bit more into what's happening with the state of indie game development and game marketing, and then we're going to, I guess, no pun intended, jump into talking about Jump itself in terms of the specifics and what it's offering indie developers. So, as we've said, you guys started to get the idea around like 2014 as things were starting to, I guess, become a little bit overwhelming in terms of the indie game market. And I guess here's a question for you. When, obviously, you mentioned Steam Direct and Steam Greenlight. As an indie developer, someone who has been looking at this market, what did you think about Valve's plans to basically turn off Greenlight, and what is the state of Direct right now?
Well, I think it was an interesting thing where they saw the issues with Greenlight, because asking a consumer directly what they want, consumers don't know what they want really until you show it to them. Mm-hmm. Because all they're going to know is what they already know. It's hard for them to see something where it's going. If it's like an unknown mechanic or unknown type of game or unknown art style, they're not going to be as privy to it as like a zombie game or a first person shooter, which you saw was the overwhelming majority of games that were greenlit. So they knew that they had to change something, but I think the floodgates were opened with Greenlight and they just can't close them. Mm-hmm. And so Direct was kind of their answer to it. But I don't know if you've seen some of the stuff that's come up with Direct recently, but 1,300 games had launched in the first few months since Direct went live. And we looked at the stats on Steam Spy the other day, and another 800 games launched, in September. And so there's just been this overwhelming flood of games, and, you know, it's just been, I think it's going to be very difficult to get your game discovered because there's literally dozens of games launching every day.
Yeah.
And this isn't just a problem that's necessarily bound to Steam. I mean, this applies to the consoles as well with open publishing policies on pretty much everything. The only console that really has some visibility left is the Switch because it's so new and dev kits are hard to come by. Mm-hmm. So, as an aspiring indie developer that's setting out, there's really not a ton of options for visibility at this point, unless you hit it big with a game that just happens to really resonate with streamers or
YouTubers and like.
Yep, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And I guess here's a marketing question for you, Anthony. From my own background, some things I've spoken to developers about, when it comes traditionally to selling a video game, be it in the retail or in digital, there's usually a 30 to 45 day window in terms of maximum profitability. This is when the game is, you know, at its newest, people aren't expecting it to go on sale, it's when it should be at the top of the new releases. Is that a factor still true, or has it been cut or altered with the rise of Direct and so on?
I don't think Direct has really affected it. I think it's just shortened the timeline. Oh. So, and again, this isn't just to Steam. I think this works on, or this applies to really any platform. So, the life cycle of a game on premium sites used to be, or premium stores used to be, 6 months to a year. And then you would see some games that would have enough DLC and kind of a consistent user base that would last a few years. But now we're seeing that cut down to, you know, the first premium spike that you're referring to lasts anywhere from a week to a month. And then there's a sales spike at, you know, holiday time or whenever sales go live. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a minimal spike because the games are on sale for 30 to 70% off. And then there's something like bundles where there's kind of a little bump in revenue down the road. And then that's pretty much it. And the timeline has definitely shortened from a couple of years to as little as a couple months.
Yeah.
And you know, the bundle thing really only works if your game is lucky enough to get in a bundle. If you're one of the other thousands of games that's not in bundles, then you really only have sales windows when sales go live. So I think the timeline is just shortened with the number of games that have come out. Because now not only are you vying for people to buy your brand new game, but to keep them around and to buy new content for your game, you really are looking at only dedicated users at that point because mm-hmm. there's just so much available otherwise.
Yeah. And as you're saying, in terms of that drop off, in terms of keeping full price, I remember last year how much of a shock it was that Doom 2016, despite, you know, selling really well, having overwhelmingly positive reviews, was already down to half off in 6 months. And at the time of this recording, I just heard that the Saints Row-inspired game Agents of Mayhem, that's only been out for like 2 months, is already at like a 50 or 60% off sale. And as you said, like back in the, you know, 90s to mid-thousands, that was unheard of. And it's just very shocking to hear these numbers happening today.
Yeah, and I think it, like you said, it actually doesn't apply to just indie games anymore. There was a good example. If you really watched some of the AAA games that came out last year, like Titanfall 2 and Call of Duty, they went on half off sales at Black Friday after launching it end of October, early November. And so they were half off literally 3 weeks after their launch. And I think that speaks to the trouble that even the largest studios are having buying for people's money now that there's so much out there. And with the rise of things like free-to-play, MOBAs, and first-person shooters like arena games, it's just getting harder and harder to get people to buy a game outright. Mm-hmm. And so it's really gone beyond indie games at this point. It's starting to affect the whole industry.
Yeah. And a major part of that, and one that I'm sure you're no doubt aware of, Anthony, is, of course, the devaluing of video games. As we've seen over the last 7 years, we've gone from $20, $30 being considered, you know, like double A pricing or kind of in the mid-tier. That's now considered for a lot of people to be highway robbery. There have been many consumers who see games as being nothing more than $10 or less, or even in many cases, free to play.
Yeah, and I think this is a kind of a double-edged sword because gamers will see the value drop because developers do it to themselves. Mm-hmm. It's really what happened on mobile, and yeah. It was a race to the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. And it's starting to happen now in desktop, and I'm glad to see that at least indie games have held at kind of a minimum of $10. There are plenty of games that are less than $10, but I think it's because those developers were scared to price it at $10. Mm-hmm. And you see varying levels of success with these games that are under $10. But I'd argue that games have held at least a higher level. But it is a little more rare for me to want to buy a $60 game, whereas that was really all I bought probably yes. 10 years ago, right? And then indie games started to come around at 10 to 15 bucks. And, it's interesting. I mean, I've been buying so many indie games recently that when I bought, PUBG, at 30 bucks, it felt expensive. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't seen the race all the way to free to play for everything yet. And primarily because that model just doesn't fit the vast majority of games. But we have seen, just the kind of the purchase anxiety go up, I would say, even if the prices haven't gone below $10, really.
Mm-hmm. And the issue, as we've said, with so many games being released, that it's becoming harder and harder to make back the amount of time and money that goes into these games, especially when it comes to the AAA market. Because we've seen this many times before where a AAA game will say that, you know, this game doesn't sell like 3 to 5 million copies, it's not a success. And
yeah, and you know, that happens in indie gaming too, where a game needs to sell 30,000 copies to make its money back. And you know, unless you have a big name behind you or a marketing team, that's it can be a tall order now because that's higher than the average, believe it or not.
So I guess from my understanding, for the people listening, what is considered the average for indie game sales?
I think you can look at, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but you can look at Steam Spy to get kind of a rough idea. I mean, it's just desktop, obviously, but it's dropped significantly from, you know, an average of, or the median being something like 50,000 all the way down to, I think, 16,000 is the last that I saw. And now that obviously includes, you know, shovelware games that never sold a copy. And it also includes games like PUBG that sold, you know, they have 2 million concurrent players. So Lord knows how many copies they've sold at this point. But, you know, it's I think it's just we're seeing just the number of games, like I said, go up, and the spending hasn't changed. So it makes sense that the average number of copies would drop.
Mm-hmm. And as we said before, it's becoming harder and harder to get your game noticed. We've mentioned discoverability, but obviously this next part will probably lead into talking more about Jump in the next few minutes. But there's also the topic of vetting games for platforms. As we've said before, one of the big shifts when it came to Steam over the last few years was going from this platform where you had to, you know a guy who knew a guy who knew someone at Valve to get your game on, to, as we said, just basically opening up the floodgates and letting anyone who could get their game voted on Greenlight, and now today, spend $100, your game's now on the store. And we'll talk more about what Jump's doing in the next few minutes. But I guess in your opinion, Anthony, do you think that stores should be more inclined to vet the kind of products they're getting on there?
Yeah, I think it's more important than ever. And that's why you see the part of what we talk about as we discuss all of our tactics with Jump and the way that we want it to work is curation is key.
Mm-hmm.
In the world that we live in with shovelware being so prevalent now, I think it's really affected the way that gamers that aren't familiar with the indie space see indie games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I ran an AMA on Reddit a couple days after we had launched back in September, and there were several comments that were talking about how all indie games are now shovelware. Mm. And so it's like a lot of gamers that aren't familiar with indie games in particular see all indie games now as terrible because of the amount of shovelware that's come out.
Yeah.
And you and I both know that there's an incredible mm-hmm. amount of really great indie games. It's just hard to find them. So curation and then a push for discoverability through curation is I think, just crucial. And I'd say that there are several groups that are still, you know, platforms or stores that still do curate. The consoles obviously are harder to get on as well, and they curate pretty heavily. So I think they do a good job on that front. But it's something that we lean on heavily is curation for discoverability for good games. And mm-hmm. and it's good for two reasons. I think it's good for developers, because if you build a good game that deserves to be found, curation will help your game get found, because you make a platform. And like the early days of Steam, if you made it on Steam, you knew that you were guaranteed a certain amount of success and visibility. But it's also good for gamers, because they can come to services like Jump and know that every game on there is of a certain quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not going to pop into a game and waste a half hour with a broken, you know, poor experience. They'll know that we have vetted it for it to come on the service. And I think it's more important than ever now.
Yeah. Now, here's a question for you, Anthony, regarding vetting. Because I did a post about this on Game Wisdom. I think it was sometime in this past summer. But one of the always tricky debates when it comes to vetting or anything with video games is setting a standard set of guidelines, you know, saying what is and what isn't acceptable. So I'm sure this will probably into Jump, and we'll get to in like the next minute or so, but in your opinion, what do you think are acceptable guidelines when it comes to vetting games?
Well, I can tell you what we do at Jump, and, mm-hmm. and because it's what I believe are the guidelines. So there's three things that we look at objectively to filter out shovelware first. And then what we do is look at everything subjectively as a second layer to see, you know, if it doesn't meet any of these three things that we typically look for, is it still a game that we find our users would want, or it's provocative or something like that, so that we know it's of the quality level that we want. So the three things that we look for are, is it highly rated? So either Metacritic scores or Steam reviews or anything like that. We typically look for like a 7 out of 10 or better. Mm-hmm. Is it an award winner? So has it been nominated for IndieCade or IGF or anything on that front? Where people that are, you know, judging games for a living, have given it the nod for quality. And then the third is it just a runaway hit seller? So is it a Bastion or a Limbo type that, regardless of what the other two, if it won awards or if it sold or if it, was highly rated, you know, we know that people wanted to play it because it sold a bunch of copies. So those are the three standards that we look for determining objectively that something isn't shovelware. But then we'll also look at it, like I said, through a subjective lens as a team and decide whether a game should be on or not. And that works both ways. So we've had games that do technically have good ratings, but we can either tell that the ratings are fake or it's just not something that our audience would want. And so we'll filter those out. And then on the flip side of it, we will look at games that don't meet any of those criteria. Maybe they're brand new. Maybe they just were controversial and so they didn't get good ratings, but it's a really great game. And so we'll bring those on just out of personal preference, based on the number of games that we see, right? Which is mm-hmm. a pretty vast number. So I think it takes a little bit of both. You can use objective filters to really cut out any potential shovelware from ever making it. but then you really do have to kind of decide individually, because mm-hmm. there's no hard and fast rule that's going to work, in my opinion.
Yeah. And as you said a few minutes ago, there are plenty of examples of really great games that are out there, but just don't have that visibility. They're not going to be award winners if no one's ever heard of them, even despite the quality there.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So I think with that, we're going to probably move into what we'll spend mostly the rest of the podcast on, and that is talking about Jump itself and what it means for any developers as well as the consumers. So, for this section, I guess the first question simply is, for someone listening to this podcast right now who has not heard of Jump at all, what is it?
So Jump, at a very high level, is an on-demand game subscription service that's focused on indie developers now. We are easily thought of as a Netflix-style service for games, but right now we've launched on desktop. So we're available on PC, Mac, and Linux with Chrome OS support as well through a web app. And what it means is that for $10 a month after a two-week free trial, you're able to play all the games you want on our service as much as you want. And it's 70 games or so right now, and we'll be adding 10 per month after that. So value proposition-wise, it works out very well because since most indie games started around $10, even if you only like one of the games on our service per month that we launch, then it's the same price as just buying a game on another service. So the value proposition is very straightforward. And as we add more games, obviously, it'll be greater to sign up initially. But we heavily curate the library, as we were mentioning before. So we look for high-quality games only. So there's no shovelware on the platform. And we use some really proprietary, interesting tech that we think is really the top solution for being able to deliver this on-demand style service. We've seen two things in the past as attempts as far as technology go. The first is streaming, which you and I both know introduces an inherent amount of latency and quality issues and requires a really strong connection to be able to run effectively. And so it's really just not scalable. And from a business standpoint, it's very expensive to run those types of services. So we've seen those kind of come and go, and a couple have hung around. But it's even EA, I think, a month or so ago said that it's going to be a few years before streaming even becomes viable on our current infrastructure. And then the other is downloadable services where you have to download every game and install it up front before you're able to play. You know, we see that anywhere from Xbox Game Pass to a couple other desktop services. And the challenge there is that, number one, you have to wait a significant amount of time before you can play any game. So it's really not on demand. And then the second is, particularly on the Xbox, you have to juggle your hard drive space with uninstalling and reinstalling. I mean, I don't have Xbox Game Pass because my hard drive is already full. So I can't imagine having to constantly uninstall games and be a part of this rotating service. So what Jump does from a tech perspective is we deliver games in less than 60 seconds. Almost all of our games load in under 60 seconds on a 15 megabit connection, which is below average for gamers, but we use it as a baseline. And our tech works that we deliver the game to your device in chunks. So it runs as if it were installed, no quality issues, no latency at all, but without waiting for long downloads and without permanent installs. So you're able to get up and running in the game very quickly without having to worry about taking up hard drive space or without having to worry about latency from streaming. So it really is a great technical solution to being able to deliver on-demand gaming. And we're introducing even more features to speed that process up of getting into games that you've played before even faster. So we launched September 19th with about 60 games. We've added our first batch in October, and we're going to be adding more starting in November.
Excuse me. And that's very interesting regarding having that alternative. I know there were talks, like another option I heard some people were saying was kind of like logging into a game and basically like sort of like playing a copy of the game online that you're not downloading. And I think it was like supposed to be like Gaikai or one of those services were trying to run that, but I haven't heard anything else from it since.
Yeah, Gaikai is actually what became PlayStation Now.
Yeah.
So Gaikai was acquired by Sony in 2012 to build PlayStation Now, which is their streaming service.
Mm-hmm.
But as you know, they discontinued support for everything except for PS4 and PC, and that's primarily because they wanted to start running PS4 games. Mm-hmm. But it was a $400 million investment for them to get it up to this point on top of whatever they've spent since 2012.
Yeah.
And it still has an inherent amount of latency, and I saw something recently where they're starting to run out of servers for people to use for PS4 games because I think that the tech is a little more limited there. So it's just a really tough kind of technical solution, and it's always going to be bound to just something like PS4 or PC. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be able to go to mobile. It's not going to be able to ever support VR because of the inherent latency. So and it can't do esports. So there's a lot that is kind of left to be desired from streaming services because of the technical issues.
Okay. Now, and I'm sure we could probably spend a good 20, 30 minutes talking about things from the tech side of Jump in terms of how you guys are trying to speed things up. And I think there's definitely some fascinating talks about it. Is there like a name for the technology for people like listening, or is that like too privy right now?
No, we actually call it HyperJump just to simplify and say kind of explain what we're talking about in a nutshell. So our HyperJump tech is what allows us to deliver games in chunks and get you up and running in less than 60 seconds in most of our titles. And then we're doing some other things with custom caching and things like that to get previously loaded games up and running even faster. Mm-hmm. So it's what we try to explain is just go try it. it sounds unbelievable. We've heard that before. Because it's not streaming, but it's also not full downloads. So how does it work, right? It falls kind of in between. So we encourage people to just go try it. We have a 2-week free trial, no credit card required. So there's literally no risk. You can just pop it and give it a shot and see for yourself how the HyperJump tech works.
Very interesting. And as you said, like it doesn't really rely on the person's own internet speed. Like over the years, I've seen my internet speed go from the days of dial-up to where it's at, like right now, like at 200 Mbps. But as anyone who knows about internet and servers knows, that it's all dependent on the server itself. It doesn't matter if you have like a 1 gigabyte download speed if the server's only doing it like around 10 to 20 megs.
Yeah, I mean, anybody with a console can attest to that.
Oh, yes.
Those are notoriously very slow server speed. So, you know, our architecture is built on what we call a serverless architecture. So we're able to deliver stuff basically as fast as your downloads are able to handle, which is great. So for somebody like you with a 200 megabit connection, you're going to be up and running in 10 to 20 seconds as opposed to 60 in most of our games. So that's really the only thing that the download speed affects on Jump is just how quickly you can get up and running in the games. But, you know, 15 megabits is the baseline that we use because that is below average for most gamers.
Yeah.
And it's around the average for, I think, just the U.S. customers now. And so we're able to get most people up and running in under a minute.
Very cool. Now, with that said, let's jump again. No pun intended. That's my go-to phrase. let's segue into talking about what Jump means for indie developers. So, I was looking at the site, and this was one of the things that caught my eye when you guys originally launched the site. And you said it was like around July that I think like the news first started to show up, and that is how the payment structure works. So, for people, or especially for indie developers listening to this, can you describe what it means to put their game on Jump in terms of compensation?
Yeah. So first I'll describe kind of when you should be thinking about bringing your game to Jump, because I think that's just as important.
Mm-hmm.
And what we say is we should be a very complimentary revenue stream to premium sales. So we're not trying to replace premium sales. We're not trying to cannibalize existing sales. What we want is to be like the Netflix or HBO to movie ticket sales, right? Mm-hmm. So in the movie industry, movies will go to theaters to get their premium sales from tickets. And then once those drop off, they eventually move to subscription services for long tail revenue. And that's the parallel that we want to draw to Jump. So you can launch on consoles or Steam or anywhere else and get your premium sales first. And as those sales drop off and you get into the long tail of your sales cycle, then it's a great time to think about coming to Jump. And the reason is because the way that we pay out is, since we're subscription services, there are no purchases, no ads, no microtransactions. It's just a flat $10 a month for all of our users. And the way that we pay out to developers is 70% of our revenue in a month is paid out to developers based on playtime.
Okay.
So we will take 70% of our revenue in a month and add it up. And then what we do is divide up that revenue based on the number of minutes spent in each game. So number of minutes in your game versus number of minutes in all games would be your split of the 70%.
Okay. And for developers listening, when they sign on to Jump, is it like a multi-month contract? Is it month by month? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So, we don't license games. So we want it to be as open-ended and friendly as possible. We ask the game stay for a minimum of a year. Just so they can give the service a shot and, you know, allow us to scale our user base as we grow. But other than that, asking to stay for a year, that's pretty much it. It's okay. Open-ended after that. They can take their game off if they'd like. But since they're at the end of their life cycle, there really shouldn't be a reason. And we're not actively going to take games off the service.
Okay.
We want this to be an ever-growing library. So what we do to kind of de-risk the whole process for them or lower the risk is we do advances on revenue as well, just for you to bring your game to the service. So a lot of developers could really use this shot in the arm of, typically it's anywhere from $2,500 to 10 grand, depending on the previous success the game has had.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll pay you that advance on your revenue upfront, and then we'll recoup that from your rev shares over time. But it lowers the risk of porting to the service and giving a new service a shot for 12 months,
mm-hmm.
So that you're able to fully enjoy Jump before your game even launches.
Mm. And in terms of like getting people onto the platform, do the indie developers have to do anything specific on their end for it to be compatible with Jump? Like, for people who are listening, if you're getting onto Steam, for instance, you have to, I think, integrate your game into Steamworks for like the API and whatnot to get going.
Yeah, so there's three main things that we do. The first is that we work with native web builds of games. That's how our HyperJump tech is powered, is by web technologies.
Mm-hmm.
So working out of any major engine or even just in native C, C++, you can be working in Unity, Unreal, Game Maker, Construct, C, C++, even some random stuff we've seen like the Twine engine. All of them have a format where they can export to native web, which would be HTML5, WebGL, or JavaScript. And we can even support web VR for some upcoming VR features that we've announced. So you have to first bring your game to a native web format, which is relatively straightforward out of most engines. And then the second is we have a Jump plugin that ties the game to our servers for security and authentication. That takes anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes. It's a super easy integration. And then the final thing that we require is cloud save being built in via one of our partners called PlayFab. And so you're able to integrate your game with PlayFab to enable cloud save for your game, because every game on Jump, you should be able to take your data from device to device. That's why we say mm-hmm. you can jump between devices as well as jump between games. So every game on Jump that has save data in it, enables PlayFab for cloud save. And, we've provided some helper scripts and some tutorials on that. So that doesn't take more than an hour or two as well.
Okay. Now, here are a few questions that I am sure an indie developer listening will probably want to know about, and I'm also curious about this as well. As we said in the last section, vetting is obviously a major part of Jump and what's going to make it stand out from other platforms. In terms of someone's like game specifically, are you going to allow for like early access games or any games with built-in microtransactions or monetization models?
So for early access games, we're going to have our own version of early access down the road. But what it'll be is a couple of very carefully handpicked games that'll get featured for maybe a month so that they can get user feedback and also generate a little revenue on the platform, but mostly get user feedback. And then at the end of that month, they'll be able to remove it from Jump and go get their premium sales on other services
Okay.
like they desire. So we're not opening it up where you can submit any early access game that's unfinished to Jump. I think that's kind of an issue with other services and the way that early access has been handled, since anybody can do it. And basically devs just started launching their games before they were finished. So again, with our curation, if we pick any early access games, which we hope to do in the future, it'll be very few, and they'll be in a specific type of format on Jump that makes more sense, where it's more like a preview than it is buying an early version. Mm-hmm. Then for ads and microtransactions, you don't actually have to use those in Jump, because you generate revenue just when somebody plays your game. Mm-hmm. So we ask that microtransactions or purchases of DLC and then any ads are removed from games, because we have ways to promote games on Jump, so that if you were launching, say, a DLC pack in the future, we'd be able to get you more visibility, which would turn into more revenue. So in the example of a DLC pack, let's say you're PUBG and you're releasing a new level like they are, right?
Yeah.
If you were to release something like that, like a new level or map pack on Jump, we would have a new featured section at the top of the app that says, you know, new content available, and your game would go into that section for a week or so. And so every game that's released a new pack or DLC of some kind, major updates, not just minor tweaks to bug fixes and things, but a major update of content, they would get a ton of visibility as if they were being featured again. And so that would drive a lot of additional traffic to the game and subsequently more revenue. So rather than having to charge for the service, because we're not going to allow any charges, just like Netflix doesn't have any additional charges beyond just subscribing, you'll be able to get more visibility and thus more revenue from the way that we'll handle new content releases on Jump for existing games.
All right. Now, here's the other question. This is one I'm sure someone's probably going to be asking. When it comes to growing Jump in the future, one of the things that we saw that was kind of polarizing, especially when it came from GOG, was switching from the original model of, you know, recreating or digitally recreating classic video games to allowing for AA and AAA games on the platform. They felt it was kind of like a betrayal of that branding. When it comes to Jump, do you guys envision getting AA or AAA games on the subscription service in the future, or do you think it will remain exclusively for the indie game market?
So the way that our tech is set up, we're able to support any type of game on any device, even though we've launched with just indie games on just desktop. But what's important is that indie games will always be at the forefront of everything that we're doing. So while we may have other types of games, whether it's old retro games all the way up to newer and larger games, indie games will always have a home in this curated platform next to any other major games on the service, so that they get the same visibility as we grow. And since we're only adding 10 games per month for the foreseeable future, you're really always going to get the exposure that you want or that you need in coming to this service. So we think that both retro games and newer AA and AAA games are something that the service would need to attract a broader audience, because indie gaming is wonderful, but as a kind of an exclusive subset of games, it's very niche. Mm-hmm. To try to get people to pay $10 a month for just indie games. So adding other games will mean we can add a broader audience to the service that's willing to pay more money and subscribe to the service over time. And that's good for everybody that's on the service, because it'll always be a small subset of highly curated games that are on Jump. So okay. I think it's important that we add other games to attract a broader audience, but indie games will always be at the forefront and will be featured as part of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And speaking about the platforms that's currently available on, as we said, it's right now available on desktop. What other platforms are you currently aiming to put Jump on?
So VR is the one that we've announced. We're just waiting for Chromium to be able to support web VR, because we can technically support it now. We're a little bit ahead of where Chromium is, and our desktop apps use a Chromium, like a special Chromium build to be able to power the native web tech games that we use. So VR will be next. And then what I can say is just that Jump's Hyper Jump technology allows us to run any type of game on any device. And so we'll have some announcements in 2018 as to other platforms and support. So, you know, to me, I think what's really important is that the Netflix comparison people are making now isn't really a good one for us, because we're just indie games on just desktop. What Netflix is access to all types of content on all your devices. And that's where we're going. We can just we can leave it at that. I think that's a good way to explain it.
All right. Now, another question that I'm curious about, when it comes to like multiplayer-based games, if someone is playing the jump version of whatever game, are they able to interact with people on, you know, the Steam version or some other platform's equivalent?
We don't completely restrict it right now. We do pay for Photon and for PlayFab for our developers. So if they wanted to use multiplayer servers and they wanted to pay for something outside of Jump, they're more than welcome to do that so that like their Jump contingency could interact with people on other services. But if they want us to foot the bill for multiplayer and for PlayFab, then it's all within the Jump client and other Jump users. So if you look at Jump now, it is very similar to Netflix in the user experience because it's more of a singular person experience. There's no friends lists or community quite yet. But obviously those features are something that are very much top of mind for us as we build out the platform because gaming is a very social activity. So as we build out more social features, there will be more to do and easier ways to organize multiplayer gaming sessions and things inside of Jump.
Mm-hmm. Very fascinating. And going back to the creation side of things, with the idea of only keeping to 10 games a month, obviously I'm sure you guys have like a greater backlog of games, right, that you're going to be playing on adding on.
Right, yep. yeah, we're in the process of building out the library for the next, I'd say, 6 months or so. So we're working with anywhere from an individual developer on bringing his game over all the way to some of the bigger indie publishers that you may know by name. Mm-hmm. And we have several of them represented already. Ed McMillan has brought his newest game, The End Is Nigh. We have a Tiny Build game. We have a Devolver game. So we're working with a lot of groups to fill the pipeline moving forward. And then as we look to other types of games as well, we have several conversations going with different types of studios.
Mm-hmm. Very, again, this is very interesting to talk about. As we've said, when it comes to the specifics of indie game marketing or just marketing in general for video games, a lot of the stuff never really gets discussed. And I think what you said earlier, Anthony, I want to come back to and touch on as we probably begin to wrap things up in the next few minutes. And that is that you're not positioning Jump as essentially, you know, the next Steam or, you know, the Steam killer. What we see a lot of platforms are trying to strive for. You guys are viewing it more along lines of a secondary source of income after the game's initial sales.
That's correct. Yeah, I think that's a very important distinction for us to make because premium sales aren't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's getting dissipated between more games, but premium sales have been continuing to increase because more and more people are getting into gaming just because the spending habits haven't changed of existing gamers. There's more people buying games. But we're really a solution for gamers and for developers that doesn't exist in the gaming space, just like Netflix and HBO and Amazon Video do for film. So we want to be a complementary source of revenue in a complementary product and service for gamers so that we're not trying to replace their existing way of life and you know, the way that developers make money, but we want to be something that's new to them and can be in addition to individual purchases.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is a very big point because as we've seen, a lot of developers or a lot of digital platforms have made that mistake of saying, we're just going to compete directly with Steam. That's not going to work.
Right.
How are you going to compete with something that's been around now for over a decade and has become such an integrated part of game development? And when it comes to like a secondary platform, it's very tricky these days to position yourself as something different. Because we've seen with stuff like Humble Bundle, as we mentioned with GOG, that they originally started as being unique, but in that time they've kind of like walked in to like the similar market as Steam in some capacity.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch them shift the way that they focus, and I think it's because we all see the same things where especially as Humble moved into their monthly bundle, they started adding one headliner per month. And some of those were AAA games, like I think NBA 2K17 is one of the most recent ones, right? And it really, as a developer, you have to be happy about that to an extent because that is going to sell more bundles because there's one well-known game in there and the rest of them can get the visibility and additional sales that they wouldn't have normally gotten without that one big one in there. So I think it's a tactic that people have just had to use. And I know that the gamers at the surface see it as annoying when somebody goes into something that they say is not their quote unquote, like first mission. But I think it's an inevitable thing that we need to support big games and small together so that everybody can coexist and succeed instead of just focusing on the niche, like just indie players, which is, I'd say, a very small subset, because I play both AAA and indie games. So a service that has both, even retro games, you know, a service that would have all three would appeal to me a lot more than a service that had just indie games forever.
And talking about the different platforms for a second, I just want to clarify this point with you, Anthony, that in the going into the future, as Jump will hopefully be able to get on more platforms, you mentioned, of course, VR and so on, will that open up the door for those respective platforms to get their games on Jump? As in, you know, if you allow for mobile to be played on mobile, can a mobile developer submit for Jump?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a really important point to make, so I'm glad you asked. So as we go to new platforms, obviously we're going to want to work with games that are meant for that form factor. So we're not going to force desktop games onto phones or into VR headsets. We would be looking for games that were built for the device that you're currently using. Now, we will have some games that work cross-platform because a lot of developers will build their game for multiple platforms. And so that'll be an especially cool thing to, like, take your save data with you from your desktop to your phone and then to your work computer, right? Like, that would be a really neat experience to take your save data from device to device. Yeah. But each device that we support will have a subset of games that were built particularly for that input scheme. So whether it's a controller or a touchscreen or a VR headset, we'll be able to open it up. So as we go to new platforms, we'll be able to work with new and different types of developers that have built for those form factors, which is great. So really any type of developer would be able to bring their game to Jump if it's that quality standard that we're looking for.
Good. And I think, as you said, that's going to be a major point of growing Jump. And again, providing that value base to the consumer, which should hopefully create more value for the developer. Now, I guess with that said, I guess this is going to be my final, I guess, Jump-related question. Then we'll move into, I guess, our final set for our cast. But this is one of the points that I was thinking about when you guys originally announced the pricing scheme, or I'm sorry, the paying model for developers. As you said earlier, it's going to be based on 70% of the revenue earned by Jump in that respective month. And then that's broken down by time or the respective time someone spent playing these games. I guess,
right.
I'm sure this is a question that you guys have thought about. I'm sure developers are listening. But as you expand Jump and obviously growing the platform again with 10 games per month, I guess, are there any steps or any thoughts regarding what's going to happen to a game, let's say, 7-8 months down the line when, you know, it's no longer just one of 70. It could be one of 150 or 200. And when there's just so many games on the service, could Jump run into that similar issue of, again, too many games vying for attention for these games to be earning at least a respectable amount of profit?
Well, I think that's where our recommendation system starts to come into play as we grow. So what we tell our developers is that we're always going to be rotating the games that get featured up at the top in our handpick rows of, you know, either featured games or something like Halloween games, which we're doing starting next week. Which will be cool. So we'll always have like a theme row that'll just feature random games and get them back up into your line of sight. But more importantly, as we start to learn about our users and see what they're playing and how much, we're going to be able to start serving up a recommendation system like Netflix does to say, okay, Joshua, you've played 3 RPGs in the last 4 games that you've tried. So here's some RPGs that you might like based on those 3 that you played before. And what that means is that it doesn't matter how old a game is on Jump, it will always be getting served back up to users that would potentially like it.
Okay.
And I think that's a really big differentiator between other types of services, and particularly just premium stores right now. They can have a bit of that in the way that they can recommend games. But primarily what we see is curators that are handpicking games that are similar. And so we don't get a whole lot of data that are data-driven recommendations in those other services. And then bundles like Humble Monthly is it's a grab bag, right? That's more of like a loot crate service. You don't know what you're getting. So we'll be able to recommend games that you should like based on what you've played and what people like you have played. And that way we can tell our developers that your game will continue to be served up to people that should like it, regardless of how old their game is on the service. So discoverability is, to kind of go back to one of our first points, it's one of the biggest pieces of why we curate. And I think that's a really important piece of how we continue to get games visibility and continue to give them the long tail that they deserve.
Great. All right. I know you have to get going in the next few minutes. And again, when it comes to talking about indie game marketing and just creating a platform, that's, you know, that's not going to be an hour-long conversation at all. And, you know, in the future, if you guys would like to come back on or other members of JUMP, I would love to talk to you to see how things are going and growing with the platform.
Yeah, that'd be great. I think we could do a check-in. We'll have some major announcements in early 2018, I'd say. And so we'd probably be doing the old road show as as Cindy takes us around to talk about those new features. So we'd love to come back on. That'd be great.
Great. So before we say goodnight for now, are there any parts of JUMP, be it, you know, getting on the platform, the running of it, anything along those lines that we didn't talk about that you would like to bring up now?
Oh, I think the main thing that I usually like to close with is for users, we'd love for you to try it and give us your feedback. The tech really is brand new, and I think it's something that you're going to be pleasantly surprised with. We have a saying, and Cindy just sent me a message that I won't curse on it just in case I'm not supposed to, but we usually say just effing try it because it seems like it's too good to be true, but really the games do load very quickly and run as if they were installed. So for users, give it a shot, give us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. And then for developers, if you have any games that are you know, beyond the spikes in their sales and you want us to take a look at them, you can submit them directly to us at submissions@playonjump.com. And in the future, we'll even have a way to submit them directly through our website. But we'd love to hear from you. We're always looking for new great games to add because we know that even as we dive through kind of the coffers of Steam and other services to find great games that are at the right time, there's so many more that we'll just never see because there's too much out there. So if you're a user, give it a shot. If you're a developer, get a hold of us. We'd be happy to talk to you.
Good. And speaking about submissions, just one last quick question that popped in my head. Are you guys actively going out to contact developers, or is it all based on submissions of people coming to JUMP?
I'd say it's probably 80-20 or maybe even 90-10 of us going out and finding developers. And we are getting active submissions, and some of those games are now live on JUMP, which is great. And we love when people come to us. But I think as we get bigger, that flow will change a bit. But for now, we're doing a lot of outreach so that people know who we are and what we're about, and they can talk to us directly.
All right. I think with that, it is definitely time to wrap things up. Again, it is fascinating to talk about this kind of conversation, and I'm really interested to see what's going to be in the future for JUMP, and even just for this style or this kind of market opportunity for developers and consumers.
Yeah, we're super excited about where we're going. I think our tech sets us up for a very positive and interesting future. And as we expand to other types of games and other devices, it's going to be a very attractive service for gamers at $10 a month. So we're excited about the next 18 months and seeing where things go.
And I as well. But for now, it is definitely time to say goodnight. So for those of you listening, thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to check out JUMP. I'll include links to the site and such in the description below. And if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, there are several options currently available. If you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future guest for a live or recorded cast, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. You can follow me on Twitter at GWBicer for updates throughout the day. And you can catch my daily discussions on game design at the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, where I'll spotlight varieties of games, as well as talk game industry and design topics. And last but not least, be sure to check out patreon.com/GWBicer for ways of supporting directly. Your donations will allow us to grow, and you get access to things such as our private Discord channel, voting for streaming and gameplays, and more. But that is going to do it for tonight. So again, Anthony, thank you so much for coming on. And again, best of luck, and hopefully we'll be talking more about JUMP in the future.
Thanks so much for having me, Josh. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Not a problem. So with that said, thank you so much for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week, and I will talk to you again next time. Take care.